I believe in churches like this because I think we're called to the people of Scotland. We are not called to be a sect. We are called to a faith which is for all. People forget just how often that word all appears in the New Testament. Christ says, I will be lifted up and I will draw all people to myself. Paul says in Romans 5, just as all in Adam were condemned, so all in Christ will be justified. Or 1 Corinthians 15, as in Adam all died, so in Christ all will be brought to life. And there are bits of the Bible that are about a remnant, and that's there, that's a note that gets played. But there's another note that's, it's all, it's a symphony. And, you know, we're just walking past two people now, and you're thinking, the faith is for you.
So here we are in the Birks of
Aberfeldy,
and I'm with Neil Glover. It's a pleasure to come through the Perthshire Hills and land in Aberfeldy to chat with Neil about your book, about travelling from urban ministry to rural ministry, and of course Seeds for Growth, among many other things, I'm
lots
sure.
Lots and lots of things.
Yes, yeah. Lots to chat about, Neil. And if you've not been into Sanctuary First's Emerging Emmaus podcast before, welcome. And we have a chance to explore what's happening in the Church of Scotland, Church in Scotland. And Neil, tell us a bit about your journey into ministry.
Yeah, I suppose like my friend Lynn, who's the minister in Ochterarder, she says that she's studied people being called into ministry, and she says that one of the signs of it is if you try and run away from it. That's one of the signs of it being true. And I think I did for a while, partly because I grew up as kind of son of a lot of ministers. My great-grandfather is a minister, so is my grandfather, and so is my dad. And my brother, who's now a minister as well, in fact, I think, if you'd known us in our teenage years, you'd be quite surprised he's now a minister. He used to call it the family business. And right. So I grew up in that, but kind of resisted it because you didn't want to feel squeezed. So I did a number of things. I used to work as a computer consultant. I worked as a outdoor instructor. I worked in India for a little bit as a youth worker. And also worked as a youth worker in Belfast. And all these things, looking back, have now contributed to me and the work that I do in ministry. I learnt how organisations work. I learnt how pension funds work. That became quite useful a few years ago when I was involved in ministers changing their pension scheme. Understand how projects work. All these things have contributed. But yeah, my journey is that I wasn't really involved in faith very much as a teenager. And then at the end of my sixth year at school, at a time when I was kind of, didn't really know who I was, I went to a rock climbing camp in Nethy Bridge, Abernethy. And through that, met for the first time, really, Christians whose lives, to my mind anyway, were the same age as me, and whose lives were more and were richer because they were Christians and not made less. And that was a revelation to me. And ever since then, outdoors, which we're in now, and Christian faith have been indelibly linked to me. So yeah, so I became a Christian at the end of my, well, just first year at university. Christian Union was a massive part of that. And then after university in Glasgow, I lived in India, I lived in Nethy Bridge, and I lived in Belfast. And all of those places really shaped my understanding of what it is to, yeah, to walk the way of faith. Yeah.
Brilliant. And you studied, and tell us a wee bit about, was Glasgow your first charge? Or
Cambuslang. So the halfway. So I lived I was a minister in a little church, well, not a little church, kind of medium-sized church called Flemington Hallside. And we lived half, our place was halfway between Glasgow and Hamilton, and so was called the halfway or the halfway if you lived there. Uh-huh. And I often thought that there was something about being in a place called halfway that I thought was quite symbolic, that you are, there's a fancy word that academics have, the word liminal. It gets yes, mocked quite a lot. But the idea of being in a place which is neither one thing or the other and is in a kind of boundary, and I guess, yeah, halfway taught me about that. What's the boundary between heaven and earth? The boundary between Glasgow and South Lanarkshire? The fact that we're always in a place which is kind of halfway, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're in the rural area of Perthshire here, Aberfeldy. Tell us what, I mean, this, it's quite, it must be very different moving from sort of urban to rural. But first of all, let's get the names, because I couldn't tell you the five names
five
that you've got.
So I'm in Aberfeldy. So Aberfeldy, this area, if you draw two diagonal lines across the whole of Scotland, they intersect. So, well, depends how you argue it. Some people say it's about 3 miles that way on the slopes of Schiehallion. Other people say it's in a wood, which is just on the other side of the wee burn that we're going past, called the Heart of Scotland Wood. So, however you call it, we're right in the middle of Scotland, the Heart of Scotland.
Yeah,
and the house that's just over there, actually, once the people living it once had a geographer turn up and said, "You're in the middle of Scotland. This is the closest
in the
house."
Middle.
So we're in the heart of Scotland, and I've had a vision for a long time about a fire in the heart of Scotland, radiating out. Partly inspired by the fire that's in the logo of the Church of Scotland, Moses' bush, which is a sign of the presence of God.
Yeah.
So Aberfeldy, middle of Scotland. And then I've got the parishes of Dull and Weem, which are kind of next door. Country parishes, lots of farms. Grantley, Logerate and Strathtay, which is lots of estates. And then I've also got, as a wee little bonus, a parish called Tenandry, which is just north of Pitlochry, and it's above the Garry Gorge. Spectacular. Absolutely love it. People have heard of maybe of Killiecrankie and Soldier's Leap. So, yeah. That was, those are my parishes, and they're all rural. There's a town, Aberfeldy, where everybody knows each other. And
as I've just found out.
I know, we've been...
What's the name of it? Is it the cat and the parrot?
The cow and the parrot.
The cow and the parrot,
cow and the parrot.
Right.
Yeah.
Fine place to eat, by the way, if you're ever in Aberfeldy. But back to you.
Yeah, Neil. So, and I guess I wanted a contrast. I felt called. And also, I was involved in Ministries Council, which leads placement of ministry in the Church of Scotland. And we were interested in the idea of how ministers could build teams to look after lots of small parishes. So I was interested in that.
Mm.
And yeah, I just felt a kind of burning call to be here and to share faith in this amazing place. And, you know, what does that look like? What does that look like to share faith with people who've never been to part of church before.
Hi there.
Hi there, how you doing?
Good.
I think, Neil, you and I are really interested in the same thing, which is how do we share faith, the news that God becomes human in Jesus Christ and welcomes all to him, reconciled through a death and resurrection that's incredible. How does that change not just churchy people, but folk who think they've got nothing to do with it, you know?
Yes.
And how do we live for that? And I think you and I are both passionate about the idea that this faith's for everyone. It's not just for the religious.
Yes.
And there's a kind of irony as well. I spoke with a woman this morning who to me is an absolute saint. She is passionately committed to her faith, very committed to Bible study, to prayer. And we'd asked her to become an elder. This is a woman who's, she was a professor of midwifery.
Right.
Very skilled, talented woman. And she said, I don't think I can become an elder because there's no way I'm good enough.
Yeah.
And you're like, doesn't matter how religious you are, you've still got to get your head around this mystery that God calls people who aren't good enough. Uh-huh. And none of us are.
Really?
Yeah.
But clearly you've been affirmed in your calling and your growing identity in Christ, beloved Son of God. And you clearly, I love the image of the fire at the heart of Scotland. And the fire in your heart to spread the good news about Jesus, to let the fire of the Spirit burn within us and to see it stretch across the land. And I know that you know there's several, you've been involved in several opportunities to grow ministry and mission, and you've written a book, I don't imagine it'll be your last one, Finding Your Voice.
Yeah.
What sparked that, and tell us a wee bit about the response to it.
Yeah, so it was sparked by the fact that I'd read lots of books about renewal of church, and a lot of them were written by people in quite large churches in North America. A few of them were written by people in churches in England, particularly Church of England. And often people wrote about a kind of church that most of the time belonged to one particular patch of the, if I can use the phrase, the theological landscape.
Uh-huh.
Quite often people who belong to an evangelical tradition, which you and I have both got very deep roots in.
Mm-hmm.
And not many people were writing about places which were smaller churches, which were embedded in communities, and which people had a whole range of opinions and theological views, but they were together because they normally shared a place. And also, I think where people did write about places, churches like ours, it didn't seem particularly exciting or passionate or inspiring. And so I wanted to write about churches like that. The other thing that had sparked my research was that I'd discovered that our Church of Scotland, particularly in the mid-2010s, was suffering a steeper decline than pretty much every other church in the United Kingdom. So we're just coming past a waterfall here.
Marvellous.
Now I'm going to show you just a spot. It means a lot to me. So we'll park that thought in a minute. I'm just going to...
Yeah.
So, 5 years ago, almost exactly five years ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And at the time I was diagnosed, they didn't know whether they'd caught it in time. It turned out they did. I had an operation, which is quite a big operation, and quite a time where a lot of changes were happening. And it was a time of challenge in my faith, challenge just all sorts of things, my understanding of who God is, and still things, all sorts of things I'm still working out now. It was also a time I'd just come off Ministries Council, so quite a big role, and coming to terms with that. Whilst I was in hospital after prostate, COVID happened as well. So it was one of the most remarkable times in life, and it's an experience I'll never forget. I'm still processing quite a lot of bits of it. About into the COVID epidemic, you did similar things as well. We did a lot of films about on YouTube, and we came to places like this and filmed it, and the national press came and asked if they could take photos of me and talk about what we were doing. So the photographer from the Press Association, pretty sure it was this spot here, it's either here or one just up, and he took lots of pictures of me standing in my robes here like I was preaching. And the photographs that he put went into an unbelievable number of places. It went in the Daily Telegraph, went the Daily Mail, went the Scottish Herald. Kind of the way these things work, I think it went to the Irish News, it went to lots of local newspapers, it was on the front page of the Dundee Courier. But the wonderful thing for me, it was a year to the day after my prostate operation that all these photos came out. And for me, for all the crisis and all the things I was wrestling with, it felt to me like God was saying, you've still got a ministry. And it was just the most wonderful validation. So it all happened on that spot there.
Brilliant. Yeah.
That spot. It might be the next one. It's funny, my memory's going, no, I'm pretty
sure.
Well,
that would be spectacular enough.
No, it was that one. It was that waterfall there. And it was great. And you know, you're maybe the same, Neil. My ministry has consisted of all sorts of surprises and all sorts of moments where I thought, God, you've got to have given up on me now, surely. And you still find yourself being used. And
yes.
One of my favourite verses we're talking about water is John chapter 7, where Jesus says, out of the believer's guts, normally English translations chicken out and say out of the believer's heart, but the Greek says guts. Out of the believer's guts, streams of living water will flow. And I've often thought a lot about that verse, how God flows through you in ways you don't expect.
Yes.
Anyway, the book. So I discovered that the Church of Scotland was growing decreasing at a faster rate than pretty much any other church. And I thought, I remember being at a seminar where I found this out, and I was gutted. I felt like we were relegated. I felt like we were the bottom of Scottish League Division 2. One of the guys in Aberfeldy manages Forfar, or assistant manages Forfar, and he talks about, what does that feel like to be at the bottom of League Division 2? That's what I felt. And lots of people would have lots of ideas about how we needed to, you know, the future of the Church of Scotland would be solved if we merged all our presbyteries, then we'd all be fine, or we got rid of half our buildings, or churches paid for themselves and didn't rely on finance, or, you know, apparently somebody told me this, they met a moderator on the train, and the moderator said, the problem with the Church of Scotland is that the ministers don't learn Greek anymore. And I was full of all these people saying, this is a problem with the Church of Scotland, we're doing really bad, and what do we do to fix it? And it almost felt to me that all these fixes were slightly superficial, more than slightly. And then I discovered a graph, because I've got a background in maths and science. I discovered a graph that plotted the decline of the Church of Scotland next to the decline of the Presbyterian Church of the USA. And I discovered it was exactly the same. And the interesting thing is, the Church of the USA, PCUSA, had done all the changes that we expected, wanted the church to do. They had lots of ministers, they all learned Greek, they had kind of bigger presbyteries, they weren't so attached to the state, and yet they were facing exactly the same decline as us. And then I discovered a whole bunch of other churches had gone through the same decline. The United Church in Canada, Uniting Church in Australia, Presbyterian Church in New Zealand, Church in Netherlands, churches in Switzerland, all of them And they all began around about, between about 1950 and 1960. Yeah. And I thought that this, we have to understand what's going on here. Why is it that churches like ours, Church of Scotland, Church of England, Methodist Church, all over Northern Europe and America, Australia, New Zealand, why are we all experiencing the same thing? And it had nothing to do with how big our presbyteries were. And I came to the conclusion it was because of a movement called secularism, which began in our sort of countries. So it began in Northern Europe, began in America, Australia, New Zealand, Protestant, formerly Protestant countries, and really began hundreds of years ago, but really began to kick in just after the Second World War. So it was to do with this movement, which had seen two things happen. One was a thing called disenchantment, where people began to push God away and the idea of God. So, Middle Ages, people believed that God was, for example, present in the heart of communion, the Mass, bread and wine, and that God was present in a kind of mystical way in the natural realm, the places that we're going through at the moment. God was never far away, and what we'd done in secular countries is we'd pushed God further and further away so that God was almost at a distance, miles away, and the world was purely mechanistic, purely governed by physical laws or economic laws. And eventually, this God becomes so emotionally distant that you have very little to do with him. Mm-hmm. So that's called disenchantment. That's the first thing. And the second thing that happened is that what's called the turn to the self. People have become much more interested in who am I? What is my journey? What is my identity? And what does my inner self tell me about who I am to become? And so there's these two movements, disenchantment, pushing God away, and then turning to the self. And that's what's happened in secularism. Those two movements have taken root, particularly Northern Europe, America, Australia, New Zealand. Formerly Catholic countries have their own story. Uh-huh. And that was the first part. We're all in countries which have experienced secularism. And the second thing is, why were our churches particularly bad at responding to secularism? And there are kind of two answers. One is that we've gone along with disenchantment. Churches like ours, which are sometimes called mainline churches or mainstream churches, we kind of, because we wanted to be respectable churches, because we wanted to have the credibility that we thought we wanted with civic society, we said, we'll kind of tone down God a wee bit. So we came up with very polite forms of worship and prayers which language wasn't just formal. I'm up for formal, beautiful language, but it was emotionally cold. And the idea of having a personal relationship with God, deep down we told our people, don't be so cheeky. You'll never be good enough for that. Yeah. And so in our churches, populations which used to go because it was expected started coming because they wanted to experience God. And instead they would say, this place is boring. One of the seminal moments for me in the writing of the book was a marketing campaign called Tomorrow's Calling for new ministers in the Church of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And the marketing executive, the top marketing executive that we worked with, came down and looked at all our plans and said it was good. And then he said, I don't go to church. He says, but I used to go to a Church of Scotland. I was in a boarding school, and every Sunday we would get our best uniform on, our kilts, our blazers. We'd walk up the main street of the town. It was Dollar. We went to Dollar Academy. And we'd come back, And he said to us all, it was easily the most boring hour of my week. Uh-huh. And I thought, that's the problem. People have turned up at our church wanting, hungering in their souls for an experience of God. And instead, they got something that was boring. Because we're too frightened of the real God. So we create this kind of tamed down deity. The God of civic society, as one of the commentators calls it. So that's the first thing. People are turning up at a place and want to meet God, and instead get this kind of tamed down.
So it's no surprise that nobody's coming.
Nobody's coming. Why would you? Yeah. It's the most boring hour of the week. And it's got nothing to do with guitars or whether you have pews or nice seats. It's, do you meet God? And then the second thing, which came as a bit of a surprise, I think I kind of knew the thing about church being boring, was that churches for like ours don't treat seriously the quest that people have to become themselves, because we actually think wrongly that it's unchristian. We think that the real job of a Christian is for the individual personality and soul to vanish and you to live completely for the benefit of others. So we are fantastic servants. We are brilliant at looking out for each other, people, for running charity shops and soup kitchens and cafes. We are so good at that. We run uniformed organisations. And I would never want us to stop doing that. But too often we've said to the people who do that, forget about yourself. What makes you grow, forget it. That's just indulgent. It's narcissistic. It's individualistic. A true Christian completely forgets about their own journey. And that lie has taken root in our churches, full of people who, if they were deep down honest, would say, I've given years to the church, and actually, I feel I'm always giving and never receiving. And our contemporary culture is full of people who want to grow. And actually, that is a Christian thing. Partly, who wants to be in a community of people, none of whom ever grow? That'd be an awful place to be.
Yeah.
But also, the Bible is full of stories of personal transformation and growth, where people don't have their personalities erased, but redeemed. And so at the heart of it, I felt, all right, that the challenge of the church is a place where we meet God, the true God, the God of fire and wind, the God who is I am, and whose name can never capture the fullness of God, because God's name is bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And also a place where, with others, we grow as the people we are meant to be, as individuals in community, the growth of the soul.
Yes.
So that's kind of at the heart of it.
Well, that's lovely, and what a spark! Clearly, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. It was very stirring and stimulating and challenging, and I'm curious to know what responses you've received from the book, you know, folk reading it. Have folk resonated with it? Have folk criticised it? Have folk been inspired by it?
Yeah, I've been delighted by the response to the book.
Good.
It's had a really good response. People have read it. I don't actually know the sales figures, but the publisher told me they were brisk, so I presume that's okay. And it's been picked up in America. People have written to me from New Zealand, England. I got a review in Church Times.
Oh, hey.
Quite pleased with that. And lots of, particularly ministers actually, have written to me and said, one said, I would want every member of the Church of Scotland to read this. I've been really chuffed because people have said it's quite readable. A couple of people said it was, yeah, no.
Yeah, a good storyteller.
Is that right? Is that okay?
Absolutely, yes. And the people that you've met as well, you're talking about real people.
Yeah, so people say it's quite readable. One person said to me, I never read theological books and I've read yours, so I'm surprised. Other people said they managed to read it in one sitting. It's had a really good response and I've been really chuffed. People have felt it spoke about a church that they recognised. I was really thrilled. I discovered the story about the book, I don't know whether you should ever be worried about such things, was the number one story on the Church of Scotland website in 2024.
Why, hey.
So, my mum likes it as well. So.
Oh, well, that's you made it.
I know.
That's good when your ma loves it. Brilliant. And I'm sure she's very proud of you. Tell me, you've been involved with Seeds for Growth. Tell us what Seeds for Growth is. Tell us a bit about the challenges, the opportunities, the hopes, dreams of Seeds for Growth.
So Seeds for Growth was started by a group of people who have responsibility for the overall governance of the Church of Scotland called the Assembly Trustees. And they had seen that each year we spend more than we take in. And they knew that in a number of years, the money would not be there anymore. The current way we have of doing church, it isn't going to last. And they'd also realised we could just wait for that day to come, or we could take some of the money that we do have at the moment and invest it in new ways of being church and forms of church, so that alongside the bits of church which have had their time, new things could start to grow. So it's a kind of brave move to say, let's, at a time when it feels like we're saying goodbye to something, mm-hmm. Let's see if we can birth something else. Somebody recently said, we've got to do two things at the same time. We've got to hospice the old, and we've got to midwife the new. And I think that resonates. And so the Assembly Trustees wanted to invest in three things. One, which you've been very involved in, Neil, is what's called new worshipping communities. People starting local groups of Christians in a new place, in a new church, and praying, worshipping, being together in ways which are new, and seeing growth. And that kind of church sometimes links with another thing called Fresh Expressions, has, particularly in England, seen huge growth. There's also some Dutch research that shows that churches like that attract people who aren't Christians at incredible rates. So the Dutch survey had found that even the fastest growing traditional church needed about 180 adult members to see one adult turn to faith each year, whereas the new worshipping communities needed about 25 new members to see one new adult come to faith each year. And we've done bits of work on that in Scotland, and seeing similar, not quite as strong as the Dutch stuff, but still very inspiring levels of growth. And I know that some of the new worshipping communities that you've been involved in, around about Troon, Irvine, and Kilmarnock, have, you know, I think about half the members are people who wouldn't ordinarily go to church. Mm-hmm. So, new forms of church. The other thing we're going to invest in is work with young people. And actually that's where a lot of the applications we've seen have come from, are people who are working with young people. And particularly what we're encouraging is faith-based work with young people. So almost all youth work projects have some form of gathering the crowds. And it could be school assemblies that they're invited into. Unbelievable number of toasty clubs. Churches are full of toasty clubs. I don't know why this has really taken off. I think because they're relatively easy to cook, they're relatively cheap, and young kids love them. So there's one toasty club in Lothian where they actually, they're in the premises of the local Catholic church, but volunteers from across all churches, and they wanted to run a toasty drop-in with 10 people coming to it, and they currently have 290. And there's a, yeah, there's another one in Davison Mains in Edinburgh. It's about 60 folk, 60 to 90. There's huge numbers. So we're just going across this fantastic waterfall here.
Wow.
Look at that.
Wow. That's got to be over 100 feet.
Yeah.
Woo.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can tell why Robert Burns loved it here. So, this is us downhill now, so hopefully we'll both be a bit more in breath. But yeah, so these toasty clubs, and they gather, they build relationships, drop-ins. And then they're trying to do a second thing, which is to grow faith with people. And that's normally with a smaller number of people. It's a bit like Jesus. You know, he would feed the 5,000, but then he'd work with the 12. And so what these projects are trying to do is share faith with younger people. So we reckon at the moment we're supporting 16 youth projects in quite a significant way all over Scotland. We reckon they've got contact with about 4,000 young people and are doing faith-based work with about 650 young people, or they will do once they've been about 3 years into their life. So that's fantastic. That's, if that, God blesses that work and uses it, that will be 650 young people,
yeah,
all across Scotland, who are meeting Jesus Christ, who are discovering God's Spirit, guiding their lives, and God growing them into the people and the communities that God's called them to be, knowing what their gifts are. And think of the young people these days, and I'm so aware of this, with young people have had three hits that we didn't have to get. One was the beginning of austerity around about 2010. A lot of services were cut back around about that time, and that really affected young people all over the UK. The second thing that's hit young people was in 2013, and I'm going to be deliberate, was when Instagram started, and that has almost certainly been very bad for young people's mental health. And the third thing that's hit the current generation of young people is COVID. And those three things together have been massive hits to young people's well-being and welfare. And what we're about is about God hopefully using us and using these projects to really grow young people in faith.
Yes, to invest in our young people, as well as others too. Of course, it's not just young people.
No, it's not. I mean, the definition of young people is quite broad. It's under 40. But also there's a third dimension to it, which is revitalising existing churches, although that does also involve young people. So there's an initiative that's being led by a guy called Graham Duffin, who's a minister in the Church of Scotland, called Growing Young, and that's based on some American research on what enables churches to...
Yes, we've had a podcast on Growing Young with Graham and others.
So that's a significant movement, and that requires investment. We're also very interested, the Church of England did research into which of their initiatives had the most impact, and they discovered that there was a course in which the leaders of the church would go in for a weekend and then spread to the rest of their congregation, called Leading Your Church into Growth. It's called LISIC for short. And they discovered that for every pound that you spent, that course delivered church growth more than any other. You'd see about an 18% rise in young people in the year after you'd done the course. That's quite significant.
So would you say that the time is ripe for sharing the good news? We had our last podcast with Justin Brearley about the turning tide in terms of belief in God, and he talks, in fact he's got his podcast about enchantment.
Yes, you know,
so it's
yes.
This re-enchanting.
Yeah, re-enchantment. That's what I say in the book. We've to become agents of re-enchantment
yes.
in a disenchanted age.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we go into schools in Irvine and we find the young people ripe and open and ready to talk about spirituality and faith. And in an age of what might be described sometimes as an age of anxiety among
yeah,
the younger people
yeah.
and many people, growing out of the three things you talked about, particularly COVID, there's a crying need for people being able to find themselves, as you
yeah,
describe,
yeah. Yeah.
and find the peace and the purpose and the intimacy and the reason for living.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's about positioning ourselves, and that's what I'm hearing. The time is right. The time is ready. The time is right. But are we getting? You know, it's the good news shoes. You know, if you think
yeah.
of the good news shoes, and the spiritual armor.
Yeah.
I've said this several times, I think, in the podcast. But you know, the great thing about the Roman army was that they had these flexible sandals that had studs.
Yeah, yeah.
And they could outmaneuver. They could go through bogs and up and over the mountains and they flanked.
So they had
enemies.
They had good trail shoes.
They did. They had absolutely. And they were able to quickly surprise. So you know, it's about positioning, it's about the good news, it's about getting into opportunities to share.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I mean, just we're looking down at the moment of on cloud, so we're above the cloud, we're looking at a cloud inversion down in the Tay Valley. It's just beautiful. So where we are is really clear. And then we're looking down, and Aberfeldy is in cloud at the moment down below. So we've just gone past the Birks, the top waterfall. And I think that cloud for me is an image of enchantment. So the Gaels, the Celts, that believed in a thing which in English is sometimes called fairy. It's spelled F-E-E-R-I-E. And there's a word in Gaelic, I think it's Sith, I think it's spelled S-I-T-H. And it's the idea that there's an enchanted world, that God is present, infusing all of world. And for the Gaels, that was about the idea that there were angels everywhere. Lots of Celtic prayers are to angels.
Yes.
That God is present everywhere, that everywhere is holy and we lost that in the Enchanted Age, and I think people are recovering that. It's interesting, and recovering in different ways. So yesterday I was talking to some of the mothers who bring their children to our stay and play group, and the week before there had been a party actually to say goodbye to our youth worker, at which the theme was either tropical or funeral, and it was to do with the fact that our youth worker, she was going off to Bali, which is tropical, and funeral was because it was where we were saying goodbye to her, so it was a kind of joke there. Anyway, a lot of these women, these mums, wore, as their funeral clothing, they wore witches' capes. I know. And I thought it was really interesting, you know, that. And I got talking to him yesterday. I said, yeah, what was that all about? He said, oh, yeah. I said, love all that stuff to do with witches and being present to that kind of power. One of them said, when I put on this cloak, I feel a kind of power going through me. And another one said, yeah, right, I'm into crystals and all that stuff. And we had a little conversation about how the church's history with witches has not been good. And you know, there's a church in Forfar which had a service of forgiveness for how we had caused women to be killed in the church. But for me, that conversation was about a spiritual hunger to connect with the spirituality of all things from these mum. And of course, what the Christian faith, particularly as it came to places around here, was about a redemption. It was about engaging with the powers, the pagan yes. powers, and people.
Hiya.
people coming to faith through that. So in Columba, walked down that place where the cloud is there. Columba would have walked that in the ways from Iona to Dunkeld. Yeah. Columba's biographer, St. Adamnan, used to spend time here. St. Cuthbert, the great saint, he spent time in a well. And all these people were about saying, this world is full of powers and it has demons and angels. And let me tell you about Christ, who is the King of Heaven. Yes. And has brought all powers under his feet, and Christ redeems the powers. And as you say, there's a hunger for this kind of world. And I totally agree with you. The age of disenchantment is coming to an end because people have locked the doors, they've bolted the windows, they've shut out God, and yet something is still moving outside. Yes. And they're going, what is that? And also, I am hungry. My soul yearns for something. And that's I agree with that. So people like Richard Dawkins, he's softening. The Republic intellectuals, you know, I know Justin Brierley talks about this, like Tom Holland, who are very sympathetic and say that to understand the story of where we are now, you have to understand the story of the church. Yes. So yeah, and like, you know, one of the guys in the town, my favourite atheist, a guy called Al, he comes up to me and says, how's God today, vicar? I don't get into the fact that I'm not a vicar. But he's desperate. And I say, Al, the problem that you and I have is, much to your annoyance, we probably agree on 95%.
Yes.
So people are hungry. Yeah, people are hungry.
Yes.
And it's how do we do what the Celts did, which is take these incredible gospel stories,
yes,
and as they did, standing in waterfalls or wells or groves, and say, the Christ is here, the Christ who is in all things is,
yes,
here,
yes.
And he loves, and just as that steam is piling down the Tay Valley at the moment, that cloud, God is present, and that great cloud of witnesses is present.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And isn't it remarkable, the Celtic saints, how, you know, within 100 years they'd been involved in converting,
yeah,
Scotland.
Yeah.
I did my study leave recently doing the Hebridean Way on my bike and went over to Kilmaloo and steeped myself recently reading lots about the saints, and it's inspiring.
Yeah,
it's encouraging, and to just be a small part of the process of seeing our land, you know, that fire that you're talking about, Neil, spreading. You know, John Knox said, "What did he say? Give me Scotland or I die."
Yeah,
you know, a heart for the land, a heart for the people.
Oh, and I absolutely, and this is why I believe in churches like this, because I think we're called to the people of Scotland. We are not called to be a sect. We are called to a faith which is for all. People forget just how often that word all appears in the New Testament. Christ says, I will be lifted up and I will draw all people to myself. Paul says in Romans 5, just as all in Adam were condemned, so all in Christ will be justified. Or 1 Corinthians 15, as in Adam all died, so in Christ all will be brought to life. And we believe in that, don't we? We believe.
Yes, yes.
And there are bits of the Bible that are about a remnant. And that's there. That's a note that gets played. But there's another note that's, it's all, it's a symphony. And, you know, we're just walking past two people now. And you're thinking, the faith is for you. My son, who lives down in Nottingham, he's forever going up to just random people and ask them about faith in God, and then he prays with them. And I mean, some of the time he's had some, I'm like, goodness sake, Sam, you got a lot of trouble there. But other times you're like, And he'll go up and says, God's telling me that, you know, you've just gone through a time of transition and God's going to be with you. And he told me one guy. Oh, the guy goes, oh, that's nothing to do with me. No changes. And Sam's like, okay, well, maybe it's, you know, maybe that's not right. And, you know, I just really felt like God's telling you you're in a time of change. And then the guy goes, well, I suppose I did move city a week ago. I think that might be it. big, oh, and, you know, the number of times, that this is, I was talking to my hairdresser about this, Helen Louise, and she wouldn't go to church, but she doesn't call herself an atheist. And I said to her, you know, I was telling her about church, and I said, you know, on Sunday, I'm going to be talking about how, you know, we all have these incredible experiences of God. And she said, yeah, God wrote me a letter once. I said, really? She said, yeah, what happened was 20 years ago, I was bringing up three kids by myself. My husband had, I think her husband had left at that point. And I said, I can't cope anymore. This is someone who doesn't go to church. Mm-hmm. And she said, God, if you're out there, I want you to write me a letter. It just came from nowhere. She just said this. And she's had enough. She's tired. She's got three kids. They're all young. She's in a council house, but a different house in Perth. And says that. She says, next morning, I wake up, 8 o'clock in the morning. I hear something getting shoved through my letterbox. She said, I thought, this is not the right time for the postman. What's going on? And I went and looked, and there was an envelope pushed through the door, and then I opened the door, and walking away was a woman I kind of knew. And I ran after her and said, what are you doing? And the woman said to her, I'm really sorry, Helen Louise, but I was praying this morning. So this woman did go to church. Yeah. I was praying this morning, and I felt God telling me that I had to write you a letter telling you that you were going to be okay. Yeah, yeah. And that God was watching you. Yeah. And Helen's like, whoa, you know, last night I'm praying God send me a letter. And sure enough, I wrote this letter, and it was just, I feel God telling me that you're going to be all right.
Beautiful.
So there's so many stories like that.
Yes, yes. And it's about being open to the real living God, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I know that's one of your daily prayers show yourself to me.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, be present. And you know, God shows up. I think one of the things we always discover is God never quite fits the programme. God does things and you think, God, that can't be right. That's wrong. I've been told that's wrong. And yet God is there. Uh-huh. And I love that when God surprises that. My friend Jo, she runs a worship course, and she says, at the start of the worship course, these people are learning to lead worship in churches. And first question, turn the person next to you and say what your name is, fine. Now, turn next to them and tell them an experience you've had of God. Hi, Joe, do you not like getting them to tell them like where they go on their holidays or what their favourite type of chocolate
is? Small talk.
Yeah, yeah. She says, no, it starts to go on.
Straight
and I said, are folk okay with that? She said, yeah. She said, they always start with a story that begins somewhere like this, like, you're going to think I'm crazy or you're going to think I'm mad. And then they tell this story. And I did it with a group of people who were thinking about becoming elders a few weeks ago, and I was a bit scared. I said, I think we've all had these experiences of God. And folk are like, oh, where's he going with this? I told them that story about Joe, and I said, now we're going to do that now. I want you to turn to the person next to you and tell them an experience you've had of God. And I went out, because everybody went into pairs and I don't want to be eavesdropping, so I went out and 10 minutes later came back in to the room, and the atmosphere was different. You just felt it. There was a spirit in the place, a sense of sacred.
Yes.
And people were saying, this is amazing. And people told stories that they've never told before. And one woman said to me, what was created there was a safe space for me to tell that story that I've never been told before.
Beautiful.
And I thought, and do you know what was interesting was that one woman said, I feel a bit left out because everybody here has told these stories and I don't have one. And I thought, ugh. So I thought, well, maybe that's not true that everyone has one. 2 weeks later, she spoke to me, she said, actually, I did. I was just too scared to tell it. And she told me the story of when her mother had died and how she'd had a very strong sense of presence. Yeah, God, lovely. Just...
finding your voice, finding your voice. Well, thanks so much, Neil. It's been an absolute joy and pleasure to hike through these, up and down this valley. And I know that I'm blessed in chatting, and I know that our hearers and listeners are blessed and encouraged and challenged and inspired by hearing you tell your stories and point people to Jesus and point people to the God who is everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
The enchantment that he's involved in.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Oh, thanks, Neil.
Bless you.
Thank you. Bless you.
And blessings. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Feel free to share.
In your neighbourhood, trudge two dumped Jesus friends, drowning before dawning, moving through a maze of misery to an amazing Emmaus encounter. Emerging Emmaus.
Good grief, our dream is dead. Going home instead, comfort of my bed.
Good grief, the pain. Hope hard to sustain, love down the drain.
Good grief, where have you been? What we've seen? Blown to smithereens.
Good grief, how our hearts burned, our minds turned, all we learned.
Good grief, don't go away, come in to stay, you've shown the way.
Good grief, how he broke the bread with hands that bled, then disappeared.
Good grief, Jesus alive, no need to strive. Chance to thrive, Jesus alive.
Good grief, no time to waste. Now we have a taste to Jerusalem with haste.
Emerging Emmaus, a well-kent lament echoes through the years. How long, how long? Good as is the grieving process, may it be a means to access visions and dreams of Christ's kingdom come. Emmaus. Emerge from the gloom. Come, Holy Spirit, come.
So for future podcasts, join us via the Sanctuary First website, Facebook page and app, and also via Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Come on, tune in.